Whoever scheduled this, this is a good back-to-back series of papers. I'm going to disavow what Cliff showed. I did the balances that he showed, but actually I'll show you why I don't believe in them anymore and why I don't think they actually tell us something useful. So I'm going to talk about inputs and outputs in the Mississippi Basin and how they relate to what we're finding in the rivers. I'm not going to go as far as Cliff. I don't really work in the hypoxic zone per se, and so I'm not going to try and link them to hypoxia. I'm going to try and link what's going on in the basin with nitrogen to nitrogen concentrations throughout the basin. So I'm not going to quite go as far. I do want to acknowledge my co-workers, Laura Drinkwater Cornell, and then Corey Mitchell and Linda Jacobson at Illinois. And the one thing you didn't hear about in Cliff's presentation is going to be a fundamental part of mine is tile drainage. And that's the big modifier. And looking at corn acres, soybean acres don't really make a difference unless they're on tile drained land. And hopefully you'll get that point at the end of this. So I'll focus on the entire basin. A lot of the analysis we did in the SAB report was at the state level, and we've since built a county level database. And I'll talk more about that as well and talk about some of the really recent end balances because I think things have changed. I think what we had for maybe the late 50s up to about 1990 to 2000 was one set of processes going on. And I think things have changed again with modern corn hybrid, with transgenic corn. And so I'll talk about some of the predictions that we can make of riverine loads. So Cliff did a nice job of introducing this. A lot of people have calculated these net nitrogen inputs, which are the inputs being deposition, fertilizer, and fixation. The outputs, grain harvest adjusted for human and animal consumption, which essentially does give you manure. And we generally thought about this net nitrogen being what's available for leaching or for denitrification or for adding or subtracting the end pools. And part of a lot of this calculation has always assumed a steady state of soil end pools. And I think that was true, and I don't think that's true anymore. And I think that we're not the only ones. I know a number of research groups in Iowa have come to the same conclusion. And we get this data from a variety of sources, the NAS data sets and fertilizer industry, and we have to make various assumptions. And some of those assumptions sometimes are where we have some problems. There's two recent changes in assumptions that completely changed the end balances, Cliff, that were in the SAB report. And the two ones were that in the SAB report, we assumed corn protein N was 10%. And I think there's pretty clear evidence that that's not true anymore, that it's now in the 7 to 8% range and declining. And so in a lot of our calculations that I'll show now, we've been adjusting for that over about a 15 to 20 year period. Makes a big difference in how much N. So even though corn yields are going up at one rate, the amount of N that's harvested is increasing, but not nearly at that same rate. And then the second is soybean end fixation. We assume typically most people end up using some kind of assumption of maybe about 50% of above ground end in the soybean plant is fixed. We're thinking now, for a number of reasons that I won't go into here, that that's perhaps gone up now to maybe 65%. But that's a big, there's a lot of uncertainty on that number. So this is the same figure Cliff showed, except now this is a new balance. This was one that now includes these new calculations. So we have the input of fertilizer. I guess I can look at it. And that has been relatively steady. This goes back to 1940, and this is for the entire basin, and these are all on a kilogram per hectare basis. We have fixation, which is dominantly soybean, but does include other legumes. And then atmospheric deposition, which is relatively low. And so those are the three inputs. And then there's the harvest number. And from our previous calculations, that harvest number is substantially lower because of the change in corn protein assumptions. And then you can see manure has steadily, it's pretty steady. In some states it's gone down, others it's stayed about the same. Human consumption is very small. So if you adjust the harvest for these two, subtract it from the inputs, you get this net nitrogen inputs. And It's we were showing a slight decline before. Now it's, if anything, it's pretty level. And at about 15 to 20 kilograms per hectare, if I can get back to that. So this was showing much more of a decline before we changed these assumptions. Now the big thing whenever we look at any of these balances is the modification that we've done to hydrology in the upper Midwest. And that's both tile drainage and channelization of ditches and rivers. And so we've created a really good system for removing water and, of course, nitrate with it. Most of you are no doubt familiar with the whole process of that, so I'm not going to go into it, but I just want to remind you. When we look at rivers, one of the rivers we've studied, Lowell Gentry's in the audience, he's sampled that more times than probably anybody else in this room. That's a high flow. There's a lot of nitrate going down the river on a spring day like that. We've got a data set now. You've all seen this before, that where nitrate goes up seasonally in the winter and spring. It declines in the summer when the tiles stop flowing and we get denitrification. But we've shown that this nitrate, most of it in central Illinois, is on its way to the Gulf of Mexico. So the big question is, how do you link these end balances to what's going down the rivers? And again, we know hydrology is the overwhelming factor. One of the ways a lot of people have done it is to look at the watershed and export as a fraction of the net inputs. And Bob Howarth really sort of pioneered this method. And in many big watersheds throughout the world, it ends up to be about 25%. So 25% of the net inputs end up in the rivers. And the thought was that the rest of that was probably denitrified. Now, if we do that for the major basins in the Mississippi River, using some of the same data Cliff showed, we can generate a figure like this, where we have different water years with water on the x-axis, so different levels of how much it rained and how much runoff there was, versus how much nitrate went down the river as a fraction of the NNI. Remember, the big picture number is 0.25. All right, well, if we start with the Missouri, we can see it's actually much smaller. Well, the Missouri doesn't have much tile drainage. It doesn't have that much flow. And then, you know, it's about 10% on average. You can see the range that occurs. But if we move up to the lower Miss, you know, we get a lot more water, but still, very low fraction of the net inputs ends up in the rivers. Then we can go to the Ohio, and things start to change. We pick up a lot of tile drainage, and the fraction gets up more, maybe on average 30%, 0.3, with some high years. And then we get to the upper Miss. And there, again, very modified by water, very different slope on the equation, and maybe getting up closer to the 40% of the fraction. But that upper Miss still includes lots of areas that are not tile drained. So one thing I can do with this is then back off on the scale. I got to change the scale. So that's all I did. I went all the way up to 3 now, and then I'm going to put two other watersheds on here, the Des Moines River in Iowa in blue, and then the Embra in green. And what you see is they jump up much, much higher. We don't have as many years here, but on average in the Des Moines system, perhaps 50% of the net inputs ends up in the river. For the Embra, it's actually over 1. And you could say, well, how can it be over 1? In fact, some years, it's 2.5 times the net inputs. So much higher fraction of the net inputs gets in the rivers to many times the net inputs. Well, there's two reasons. One, it can be carryover from a dry year to a wet year. But the other reason is we think that the assumption of no net soil end depletion no longer holds, and that we actually are starting to see a depletion of soil organic N. It's not a very big one. Soils in this watershed have perhaps 15,000 kilograms per hectare N of nitrogen per hectare in the upper meter. And so maybe some years were 30, 40, 50 kilograms coming out of that soil. So to investigate this further, we've gone with a county level data set, over 1,700 counties in the Mississippi Basin. We did this for a 10-year period and gathered essentially the same data we had at the state level. And we also got data for 194 watersheds within the basin where we have winter, spring nitrate concentrations and calculate the loads, and tried to come up with a predictive model that we could apply to all counties in the watershed. And so these are kind of maps that you can make, and this isn't anything that anybody's unfamiliar with. This would be the fertilizer N applied in kilograms per hectare per year. One of the things you quickly realize with this kind of data set is how co-correlated everything is. Well, where's the high fertilizer? Where you have high crop acres, which are dominated by corn. And then the other thing we find is it's where the tile drainage is. And the tile drainage really is in the corn. The best soils are the tile drain ones that are the most heavily fractioned and have corn and soybeans and are the highest fertilizer. And so that's the Corn Belt from Minnesota down through Iowa and across into Ohio. This is a map that we've been able to work with a group at WRI to put together estimates of the fraction of the county that's tile drained. Now, if I look at net inputs, net nitrogen inputs, this is what I get. And in fact, the Embro River that I showed you, nitrate, is right in here. And some of these counties have negative balances for that 10-year period. But yet, we know lots of nitrates coming out. What this shows is this picks up a lot of the high manure counties. And that gives us the really high net inputs. But the counties with really productive corn and soybeans actually have very low net inputs, to the point that they're negative, even over a 10-year period. And this is new. If you had asked me 5 years ago, I would say this is a really good predictor of things. Now, because the underlying assumption of no change in soil organic N has perhaps changed, this map does not relate very well at all to what we see in rivers. We've also tried an imbalance without soybeans, trying to take out the sort of, because we know soybeans are a net depleter of soil nitrogen. I mean, they fix some, but they also mine the soil. This doesn't work any better. And in fact, when we try and relate this to the nitrate concentrations, it doesn't work. So the model that we came up with is very similar to the Mary Booth model that Cliff showed in his talk. And the model for predicting January to June for these 194 watersheds in the basin, we got an R squared of 0.86, and it's basically flow adjusted for fertilizer N per hectare, manure, plus a sewage effluent term, so a human consumption, and a tile drainage term. I put fertilizer N per hectare in red because I totally agree with what Cliff said. It's not as simple as saying it's just some fraction of fertilizer that's being removed. It's much more complex than that. The fertilizer N per hectare is just an indication of the intensification of agriculture on tile-drained land. And so, yes, it's related to fertilizer, but it also means that's where we have the highest crop fraction, and that's where we have the highest tile drainage, although we were able to get tile drainage out as a separate term. When we look at how much of the overall variation was explained by this, 77% was by the fertilizer term, 13% by tile drainage, 8% by human consumption, and manure was actually significant, but also explained almost none of the variation. So what this says to me is that where do we find the highest nitrate loads, where we have the most intensified tile drain corn and soybean agriculture? And with a few spots that come up because of, like, Chicago or some of the bigger cities where we have sewage effluent. So if we plot this out, use that to calculate then for every county in the basin, this is what we get. So this is modeled January to June nitrate export in kilograms of N per hectare. Our high end here goes up to 15 to 25 kilograms per hectare. We know on, say, the Embro watershed that we monitor, we've seen up into the 50s kilogram per hectare lost some years. And again, it looks like many of the other maps, the highest loads are the tile drain corn belt. And so this is the dilemma that we have. This is not an excess of fertilizer. These are actually either negative balances or almost balanced nitrogen, yet we're losing lots of nitrate. And we think a lot of it has to do with the change in genetics in corn and the genetic modifications that corn are able to access the root corn roots are able to access nitrogen extremely well in the soil, and that this is leading the other source of N that we don't have an indicator for is nitrogen from soil organic matter. So the big conclusion that's, for me, a big change is that nitrogen balances really don't seem to tell us very much, that this is a big change. They don't relate well to nitrate loss across the basin. And so watersheds or counties with high fertilizer inputs have high crop fractions, have high corn acres, they have tile drainage, and all of this is what's leading to what we see going down the rivers. The row crops on tile-drained land are much more important than manure, atmospheric deposition. For example, the Sparrow model gives very high correlations or explanation of nitrate loads to atmospheric deposition. We don't find that. Human inputs, sewage effluent, are important, but again, it really is dominated by the row crop system. Now, this is where our analysis could help to target where we should do things. And this is where we're at. There's a, some of you may be going, I'm sure, to the workshop in Des Moines next month, because that's the sort of the next step here, because there's a number of models and they don't all give the same reasons and the same same sources of nitrogen, and we really could target different areas of the basin in terms of where we're going to try and reduce nitrate. So again, the big conclusion that, and for me this is a big one, is that nitrogen balances really don't seem to be the answer. So I'll stop there.
Let's start off for any questions for Mark here on his presentation, and then we'll follow on with any others that we might have.
So we want to hit the light back there?
Yeah, right in the corner. Hit the blue top button there.
Could you comment on how managed drainage would affect nitrate loading?
Yeah, well, managed drainage, a lot of us are interested in that. Managed drainage, for every indication I've seen, for those who don't know, it's basically backing the tile line up in the winter and early spring. Seems to really work. The big question that nobody's really answered is, where does the water go and where does that nitrate go? And I think there's a lot of questions on that. I think I just got a new project to work on that. So I think that looks very promising. You have to have the right lay of the land. I mean, it has to be really flat, but that's a technique that can work. There's a lot of techniques that can work. The problem is the scale of the problem means there's got to be a lot of it.
In terms of soil organic matter, then are you working on, or do you have information on, I know this has been working on a lot, the amount of mineralization that occurs?
We have limited data on that, and that's, you know, especially when you start to look at this scale, that's a really hard thing to get a handle on. We had done a study where we had resampled things after 100 years and 50 years, and we're able, at that time, we hadn't seen much of a change, and that was really 1950s up to maybe 2000. But I think there's a new change that's occurred. And to actually document that, that's a really hard thing to do. I think we need to do that, but I don't know, you know, that's a really hard thing to do.
Somebody else?
So it's the same question.
Mm-hmm.
Mineralization.
I mean, we know we have big mineralization every year. We have immobilization. It's that slight difference that really matters. And pinning that down, and, you know, from one year to the next, a wet year, you may get one pattern, dry year, something different. What we need is over 5 years, 10 years, what's going on there. And that's very difficult to get. Dan.
I was a little surprised, if I remember your numbers right, that manure explained to be 1%. It's, at least in Iowa, we know that there are certain counties that, you know, are getting way too much nitrogen. Most of that's because of excess manure and then the pre-commercial fertilizer on top of that. Is that 1% kind of it? One way of looking at it is 1% of the counties where manure is important? Or is that probably not the way to look at that?
No, you can't really look at it that way.
But I'm just surprised it's so low.
But I guess, you know, Iowa shows up as having, you know, we're predicting very high nitrate loads for it. Can those counties not, do they still have a high fraction in crops?
They're still high in crops.
See, that's, so it's probably another co-correlated variable that's really hard to separate out. You know, it's part of that intensified agriculture. So it's tile drained, it's corn and soybeans, and maybe it's got manure. And then to pull the manure out on top of the other factors, maybe that's where we're not getting it. Well.
Can you sort out fall nitrogen fertilization at all?
Not in this kind of analysis.
Any trends? Is it still going up?
I don't think it's going up, but I mean, that's no doubt that when we say intensification in the whole system, that's part of it. How much of a part? With this kind of approach, I can't even begin to tell you.
You'll pretty quickly realize I'm not from the Midwest, so I'm not familiar with the situation up there. But there must have been studies over the last 20 or 30 years looking at sub-basins or smaller watersheds directly at what's coming out of the tiles.
Oh, we wish.
Do those go along with what you're saying, that there's no change as you change practices up in the fields?
Well, virtually nobody has a long-term tile data set. We don't even have that many long-term river data sets. But nitrate concentrations were first really measured in the 70s in tiles. Jim Baker at Iowa State was one of the first really to do some of that. Giles, who was here, had a lot of tile drain. But I don't think there's any evidence. I mean, we haven't really changed the cropping system. What we're saying is there's a change in where some, initially we had surplus N, now we don't have surplus N, and we've changed the one of the sources that of where how nitrates, the source of it, it's gone from more of a surplus to mineral, maybe some being mineralized N. But you'd so you wouldn't pick that up even if you had a tile drain.
Really?
Why? Well, nitrate would be the same. It's just where it's coming from would be different.
That's what I mean. It's staying the same even though practices in terms of fertilization of the field haven't changed.
Right. I mean, Dan, would you agree that, I mean, tile drainage numbers haven't changed?
They haven't changed.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I don't know if you have time right now, Mark, or not, but I'm wondering a little bit about the differences between your results and the sparrow findings. You pointed out that there are some differences. I don't know if you can touch on that a little more or not.
Yeah, and sparrow does it, I mean, they have a more limited, in some ways, data set of the cropping system, but they have other things much better than what we have. Sparrow also gives delivered numbers. These were not delivered. These are concentrations in the watershed, so that's one difference. But Sparrow gives much higher amounts always to manure, particularly for phosphorus, but and then atmospheric deposition. It's a statistical fit. I've always had a hard time explaining that. And so I can't, they are different in that, I can't say who's right.
Can I follow on that a little bit? Mark, in visiting with Rich Alexander and Richard Smith in Western Virginia this summer, I asked this question in the model how they determined what the loss was, and they said, well, if it's corn and soybean rotation, it has a coefficient. As an agronomist, what I see in the field working 30 years, no two fields are the same, and one coefficient for corn and soybean acres, to me, doesn't make a very good model, except on a very gross scale. So I have very strong reservations about taking the sparrow model until we have more regional scaled down versions to verify the accuracy of the model on a more local scale, taking that model and making it fit and targeting, like Mark said. I think there's some real question marks we need to raise about the validity of that approach at current.
Yeah, a lot of us have a lot of questions about sparrow. I'm not saying this is the answer either, but things come out quite a bit different. And it also points out, though, the difficulty, and Cliff and Andrew and I were the authors of the authors, and Andrew actually led it, of the table in the SAB report that says, well, what do we do about this? And we really struggled with that. And the main one was, well, we need to change the road. We need more complex rotations. And that's really the problem. We have a very simplified system. But then we had a big but that said, well, we're not likely to do that, so here's all these other things. And that's the real challenge, I think. These systems, so the point is, corn and soybeans under the best of circumstances are really leaky systems. And the balance, you know, there used to be, well, it was this big, because we had this net surplus, that was what's coming out. It's clear that that's not the case, which makes it even more challenging.
Thank you, Mark. We've already been involved in the discussion here on some of the follow-up questions that we've had, but are there any other questions for the rest of our presenters? For Cliff, Doug is still here? Doug's here still. Gilbert, I don't see Courtney or Robert.
Could I raise a question?
Yes, please do.
Could I raise a question and also answer it?
Yes.
Could it be possible to
seed your own question?
There's one slide I wanted to show just because I'd like feedback on it, if you guys would permit me that. I'm interested in knowing the impressions that it leaves with the audience.
It should come up here for you.
Okay. Thank you for permitting that.
Well, we got plenty of time.
I don't know how to move to the.
Don't go too far because it might be way ahead of you.
Okay. Forgive me for those of you in the audience who are anxious to leave. You don't have to stay.
Good for people who
okay. As you can see here,
It's about as fast as I talked. Oh. I mentioned some nutrient use efficiency efforts we're working on in the Institute, and this graph was showed earlier today by Paul Fixon showing partial factor productivity for corn in the United States, showing that we weren't doing so well in the 70s and we're doing better now in producing corn per unit of nitrogen input, which may go back to the genetics point that you raised, Mark. And the reason I wanted to show this particular slide is that it was my attempt to find out, well, if what we're encouraging people to do in measuring their agronomic performance in the field, if it has any relevance to any nutrient discharge. So I just took the total nitrogen flux to the Gulf of Mexico for 84 to 2007 and plotted against the whole U.S. corn partial factor productivity, because I didn't have it on a basin basis. But it was interesting to me that there is some relationship there, and it's statistically significant. It doesn't say cause and effect, but it makes me think if we try to do a better job of using these metrics of measuring in-field over time, our performance at the field scale maybe, and we ratchet that up to a larger scale, that maybe we can get some idea that we're doing a better job or not doing such a good job over time, and that has some bearing on the loss of nitrogen to our water resources. So we're using this somewhat as an educational tool. Again, it doesn't imply cause and effect, but it makes me think that, you know, when we do better job agronomically, that there is some potential that maybe we could ratchet down our losses as well simultaneously.
But that's a total N. Total N's been really declining while nitrate hasn't.
But total N is explained by about 60 to 70% of the nitrate N, and I think the two are highly correlated. I agree. This was just a crude attempt, Mark, just to see if there was anything there. I probably should have looked at nitrate. I could have thrown nitrate on there and done that too. I need to follow up with that. But I'm just curious what you guys thought as metrics. Farmers can't measure this in their field, so what is a surrogate measure of performance over time to have them get some sense for how well they're doing? Some speedometer, if you will. We're advocating they consider two. One is a partial nutrient balance, which you've blown out of the water now with your suggestion that a nutrient balance approach doesn't tell us all the potential for loss. Anyway, something to think about. You can give me feedback if you'd like after. Thank you for permitting me the time.
Any other questions? Well, thank you to all of our presenters and keeping us on task here. It was a great session. I'd encourage those of you that can hustle over to room 306 to go catch the premiere of Dirt, the movie. The first showing of it is here in about 15 minutes, but thank you all.